Here we are again with another episode of The Boneless Show. Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, and I have with me in the studio the entire Boneless team. Mott, Boneless Man Extraordinaire.
Yeah.
Ted, editor of Boneless, who does a bunch of other things too. And Steve and Candace. Candace, of course, founding editor of Boneless. And Steve, who is not only her husband, but also oversees the young adult ministry here at Focus on the Family.
I get the serious intros.
Who attends that?
Cartoon characters.
I had to work up to it.
Yabba dabba do.
Yeah, we're going to come up with something better for Mott next time.
Mine's just all in the past, so.
Okay. All right. Okay, well, today's show, we're going to be talking a little bit about, there's going to be some dichotomies here, some pull. So we'll obviously just chat about some of our experiences with the Olympics, both good and bad. So we'll talk about that. There's a little bit of a disparity there. Our roundtable today, you'll want to hear, we have three guests in the studio to talk about the challenges and the joys of working in the secular corporate world. And these people did real stuff. So you want to hear about them. These aren't just people that, you know, whatever, had their own at-home businesses. Okay. already been hearing the music from Nathan Clark George, and you've loved it, but now you're actually going to get to hear him in the flesh, his own voice, fresh from the RV with his family. So that's going to be great. And then for our Q&A, we're going to be talking about marrying in college when your parents don't want you to. That is some dissension right there. So stay tuned, and we will jump into that. But we are in the middle of the Olympics. None of us are competing. We want to just clear that up. We did have the interview with Eli Bremmer, who is, and so we want to make sure that you catch him next week in the Modern Pentathlon.
Hey, how do you find out more information about Eli Bremmer? Is it elibremmer.com?
Elibremmer.com, yes. Right. Elibremmer.com. So find out more about him there. You know, catch his event. Find out more about the event, because as I've said before, it's totally whack. So you want to just watch it.
He's like a stud.
He's cool.
It's pretty whack. So, but what are we watching? I mean, we've been watching so far. I will say, and I told you guys this morning, I can hardly walk because I started a new weightlifting program. So now, I'm going to get ambitious, and I think that within 3 weeks, I'm going to look like the men on the men's gymnastic teams. So that's my new goal, because I was doing the arms this morning. I'm just saying, but. What have y'all been watching?
Well, we are not watching the beach volleyball because they play in their underwear.
Because it is scandalous.
Well, not the men. The women do.
Right. The men wear, you know, these polyester jerseys and long shorts. And the women, prime time, of course, right? And so we had to turn the TV off and read a library
book. A lot of
flash.
Yeah, we turned it on and had to turn it off, too. Sitting there on the couch with my whole family.
With the little kids. Yeah, they're like, Mommy.
With my daughter saying, why are they in their underwear?
What are the sports where people are fully clothed?
Fencing. Eli will have on a full uniform.
Plus a mask over his face.
Okay, but think about it is an improvement on the original Olympics, though, right?
I mean, wasn't that? Yeah, they were pretty much naked.
Buck naked, right?
Yeah, Greeks. Greeks.
So one thing I'm a little bit concerned about is, I don't know if you all saw that story where they swapped out the girl who was singing in the opening ceremonies, the little girl, and they had the one with the super cute little pigtails, but the one who had the voice was not even represented. So it was kind of a Milli Vanilli opening ceremony with the one girl singing, because apparently she was not attractive enough. She was chubby and had bad teeth.
Yeah, but the moderator said, these kids represent your average Chinese. Mm-hmm. And that's what we love about it, is that they're not superstars.
From all the villages.
Yeah.
I think it's so concerning that you can't really trust what we're hearing from our own sports commentators. Yeah. How do we know what's real? Yeah. Because, one, they're operating under a little bit of a fear that they'll be, you know, the plug will be pulled on their satellite uplink by the government officials. Right. And so they've got pressure to put on a certain face. And so I'm watching going, well, how much of this is real?
Well, one of them was giving Bush advice on China relations in the beginning. He needs to not do this or do this.
Yeah.
And just to hear them just promote the Chinese propaganda is a little disturbing.
Well, you know, I think we all know that the whole how you engage with a superpower like China, that they're obviously the largest country on the earth. They represent, a fifth of the population of the world. And we know
that... They make
that
most of our consumer goods.
That's right.
Including the microphones we're speaking into now.
But we know that we are supposed to engage with them in a meaningful way. We can't just ignore them. And so that was the whole debate about, should we boycott the game? Should Bush be there? And, you know, Bush chose to be there and to actually demonstrate respect and hopefulness in the relationship. But also he did take the time to point out the religious liberty infringements, the rights that are being abused in the country. And I think the balancing of that can be really difficult, is how far do you really engage, and how far in the process of engagement do you actually end up glossing over these abuses?
Well, you know, the commentators keep saying how they're amazed that the last time they were here, all they saw out behind them on the street were bicycles, and now they see all these cars. And isn't that just evidence that China has come so far? And I'm thinking, you know, there was a pastor bicycling to the church that President Bush was at on Sunday, and he was arrested on his way. And his brother was quoted in the Wall Street Journal today as saying they don't know where he is. That, to me, is better evidence that things haven't gotten all that much different or any better than the fact that they have more cars than they do bicycles.
Hmm. Well, and the opening ceremony, it really was beautiful, and it does remind people of just the incredible heritage of the Chinese people. I mean, reminding us that they gave us printing and the press, paper, all these different...
Fireworks.
I mean
fake
that was...
fireworks.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were fake?
Well, yes. No, some
it
of it was...
It was pre-recorded.
CGI.
It was mixed into the
I can't
the
trust the
ceremony.
Fireworks.
You can't.
Oh, no.
But there are a lot of good fireworks that do represent their heritage. But I think it's very possible to appreciate the art and beauty of the Chinese culture without allowing that to allow us to turn our heads towards some serious abuse.
It seemed like everything they were doing, I mean, even everything the announcers would say was about putting on a good face for the Chinese. They want to appear good, you know. It's kind of like maybe all of us do.
Well, if nothing else, I mean, as all of us Americans, as you're listening to the Olympic coverage, as you're reading about it and watching it, just remember, please be praying for China, for the believers there who are suffering persecution, for the people who are being expected to put on this good face, even in the face of the reality that they will have to go back to once all the cameras are gone.
One thing that I think is really good is, you know, we can remember the many people that are over there, not only the athletes, but folks who have gone over there, you know, to distribute Bibles. They've gone over with their churches to kind of have a presence at the Olympics. I know my friend Jen is there with her church distributing the scriptures. And obviously Eli is there. We talked to him about his witness there as an athlete. So I think it is good for us to remember to pray for these folks. And I don't know, Candace, would you be willing to pray just for the people that are in China now, not only the Chinese, but the Christians that are there having a presence, the athletes that do as well, and just put them before the Lord?
I will. Thanks, Lisa. Lord Jesus, thank you that we live in a country where we are free to praise your name, to speak openly of our love for you, and to worship you without fear of any kind of consequence. Lord, I pray for the believers in China, men and women and children who are risking life and limb to serve you. And I pray you would protect them, that you would bless them, that today you would fill them with your joy and your spirit-infused power. And Lord, I pray for the athletes who know you, that they would not be intimidated, that they would continue to bear witness to your presence in their lives, whether it's on the medal podium or just in their conversations at the Olympic Village. And Father, we pray for all of the friends we know and others we don't who are serving China as missionaries, who are there and at times in peril. Lord, we ask that you would protect them and make their ministries fruitful. And Father, we thank you that your presence is so powerful, that your truth is so transformational, that often it flourishes in places like China exactly because of the persecution. And we do pray that there would just be an outpouring of your spirit there and evidence of your presence, and that much good fruit would come out of this Olympic time, whether we can see it or not, Lord, that the outcome of this would ultimately be for your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.
Behold, children, are a gift of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is a great reward, like arrows in the hand of a mighty man. quiver is full of them. They shall not be ashamed when they speak with foes in the gate. Unless the Lord build the house,
for today's roundtable, I have with me in the studio Clark Miller, Deb Rush, and Rich Bennett, all current Focus employees, who we're actually going to talk today a little bit about a transition that they've made and the time that they spent in their former lives in what we would call maybe the corporate or the secular workplace, though they have now reach the promised land of Christian ministry where all things are good and you never have conflict or never have problems or any
all
issues.
All chefs of light and angel choirs. Yeah.
Exactly. So they've come home into the fold. But why don't we go around and just introduce yourselves quickly and tell us what you do currently here at Focus.
I'm Clark Miller. I'm a senior vice president responsible for our family ministry area.
And what does that mean, Clark?
Family ministry is
it's what does
the
that
good
have to
stuff
do with focus on the family?
It's the good stuff. It's everything we do from a programmatic or media perspective that's designed to minister to kids or teens or young people or married couples, parents, grandparents.
Okay, awesome.
Great. I'm Deb Rush, and I am the executive director of what we call the M Group, which stands for Marketing Group, and we do the in-house advertising and promotions.
Creative people over there.
Creative,
and
yes.
Fun people. So we like to visit them.
And I'm Rich Bennett, and I'm Vice President of Family Outreach. I work with Clark, again, to just inspire and equip people at every stage of life, from marriage and parenting to the stage we're going to be talking to today.
Okay, great. Tell us a little bit. We've all been at Focus now for a while, each of us. Rich probably is the most recent addition to our staff, I would say, out of this team.
It'll be 4 years in the fall. Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit, just again, a brief introduction, and you can jump in as you will, of where kind of what some of your experiences were before Focus, just generally, and then I'm going to actually launch into a couple specific questions about those experiences. But Rich, why don't we start with you this time around?
I actually came to Focus from two different Fortune 100 companies, and I think a lot of people are surprised when they ask the question, oh, well, you came to Focus on the family. Well, that's just got to be completely, totally different. How did you make that adjustment? And what I say is, the practice of what I do in terms of the discipline of how do you communicate to people, how do you connect with them is really the same. I think that when I think about what I did at Sprint and helping to sell wireless phones and what we do here in terms of helping build a richer, deeper relationship with Christ, it's obviously a little bit like the difference between shooting a bullet and throwing a bullet. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the discipline of what I do, it's very similar. And so I think some people are surprised by that. And I would also say similar is, Lisa, you made a joke at the onset about, everything is just peace, love, and harmony. And it turns out that there are sinners mm-hmm. at Focus on the Family, just as there are sinners in Fortune 100 organizations. And so
I just found that out like for the first time about 3.5 weeks ago.
Yeah, and it's shocking that first time that happens. Yeah.
My halcyon period is over. Yeah.
But having worked in church leadership as a layman prior to coming here, that prepared me well for the fact that even though people are trying to be Christ followers, there still is that element of sin that we fall short as a result of.
That's true. True enough. Deb, how about you?
Well, I came from actually advertising agencies, four of the top advertising agencies, and they all had one client in common, which was McDonald's Corporation. So I pretty much worked with owner-operators of McDonald's franchisees for the last 10, 15 years of my life.
Wow. Did you have to, it looks like you're in good shape, so you didn't eat a lot of McDonald's, or have you shed that since coming to Focus? I'm just saying,
I've
you
been,
look pretty good.
My side thing is to get outside, so I spend every weekend. As a matter of fact, I just came off of 6 days out in the wilderness, so.
That is true. Deb does that. She does these wilderness treks with her husband
yep.
that are pretty hardcore. So,
yep. So well, we like the outdoors.
Okay, so the ad experience, and Clark?
I worked for a number of food companies.
Also not McDonald's.
Yeah, we love the food. I eat Deb shared McDonald's, so okay. We're covered. I loved my experience working for those companies. But something, it's kind of hard to explain, just I wanted to do something that had a little more lasting value. And I got tired. We used to call it living by the box score. It was always about what are the orders, what's the share price, what's your forecast for the quarter. And that's energizing for a while. But after a little bit of time, you kind of start to think about, is this all there is? Was I made for this purpose? Was I made to sell potato chips and strained peas and spaghetti? And for me, it just wasn't. And so I decided to try to use those same, as Rich said, the same kinds of skills and the same kinds of environment, but in an organization that hopefully has a slightly higher purpose.
Okay. Let's talk about your entrees into the workforce, straight out of college or however you found yourself on that path. Tell us a little bit about, were you a Christian entering the workforce? Were you not? And what really was your first experience? What was shocking to you? What wasn't? Just about the whole culture, and how did you find your way in the midst of that? Whoever wants to jump in.
I'll start. I was a brand new Christian. I came to the Lord my senior year of college. And so I was brand new. And my first job out of college was working for an advertising agency. I don't know if Deb would agree with this or not, but I found pretty quickly that almost every stereotype you have about an advertising agency is more or less true.
More or less true.
So the carousing and alcoholism and doing whatever it takes to serve the client, those were all things I sort of were exposed to pretty quickly, and it was a real conflict for me, frankly. And, are you going to do this to please the client, but it goes against your what you believe your moral principles are, and where are you going to draw that line? And that was an early struggle for me.
So what did you do to buck the tide?
I got out of the advertising agency business.
Just remove yourself from the situation.
I went to work for one of my clients.
Okay.
Honestly, that's what it was. That is the reason I got out of the business, is it was a conflict for me, and I did kind of like the client side better, but I just got tired of having to make that choice every day.
Okay. But obviously you didn't go to another company and all of a sudden there were no moral difficulties or anything, so.
No, but they were different.
Okay.
A whole new set of moral challenges to address.
What would be a good
example? When you work for a publicly traded for-profit company, there's enormous pressure on the bottom line. Mm-hmm. It's all about, the ends justify the means in most cases.
And
a lot of those organizations, they don't really care what you have to do to deliver the number. As long as you deliver the number, that's really your only objective. They don't care who you walk over, what you did to deliver the goods, as long as you did that. The other challenge I would say is, for me, this is not a moral dilemma, but it was a problem for me in terms of short-term thinking. There was so much short-term pressure, again, on the number. That you make a lot of really questionable business decisions. So you've got some moral decisions and some business decisions that I struggled with a little bit.
Okay. How about either of you two?
Tagging on to Clark's world of the advertising world, it is quite a lucrative business, and you really have to, stay up with all of the major trends, and a lot of times that gets you into the cultural things that you probably do or do not want to step your foot into. So for many, many years, I was in that world with the advertising group. But I will tell you that I come at that. I was not a Christian when I in the corporate world. Until late in life. And when I came out of that corporate world, I actually had a mentor that was inside the corporate world in the company that set such an example for me that I kept saying, I want what he has. I want what he has. There was such an upstandingness about this gentleman that it just made me, question how I was acting and why could he be in the same realm that I was, same corporate company, but yet he had a different perspective on a lot of different things, and it just seemed life would work. And when the hard times were hard, he had some place to fall back on. Mm-hmm. And that was just really a changing moment for me. So as me looking back, it's if I could be that to anyone like he was for me, that's what I would say is a really key takeaway for those of you out there that really are a strong Christian in the workplace. You will make an impact.
Mm-hmm. And people notice.
People notice.
Yeah, it's not just about, people. I think there is the misperception that a lot of people are sitting in their cubicles or in their offices and they're just getting their job done. But we talked in a previous week on this subject, and I said just the impact that you have in sharing one another's lives. I mean, who doesn't come in on a Monday morning and talk for at least a few minutes about their weekend? I mean, it's not like you're just working with fellow, you know, robotic animatrons or whatnot. You're investing in people.
So and there's subtle ways to do that. It doesn't have to be that be it in your face type of discussions, but those subtle things really over a period of 4 years for me had such a impact in my life that he's actually the gentleman that brought me to Christ.
Yeah. So maybe going easy on the chick tracts and maybe utilizing other means as they come about. So, Rich, how about you?
Well, I think Deb's right. I think whether you always want it to be the case or not, people are watching. And I think when whether you've expressed it very directly or indirectly that you're a Christian, people do take notice of that. And I think, I don't recall ever telling anybody, hey, don't use swear words around me in the organization. And yet when I would be in meetings, and I think the sales and marketing area, I don't know what your guys' experience is, but tends to be at times a pretty foul-mouthed practice. And I remember being in meetings and somebody going off the deep end with their language and then turning to me and saying, oh, sorry, Rich. And again, at no time did I say, hey, you're not going to be able to use certain words around me. But I think, you know, I don't know if it was me reacting to those. I don't know if it was Rich as a Christian and therefore, and it could be as simple as they didn't hear me saying those words. But I remember that distinctly, people stopping meetings and looking at me and saying, oh, you know, sorry about that.
I once received a performance review where I was told I should cuss more.
Oh.
That would be an enhancement to my career if I cussed more and had a more violent temper. And I was actually counseled to break a piece of furniture in a meeting. That would really help my esteem in the organization.
So did you do it?
Yeah. No, I failed.
No. Is this when you went to yet another organization?
No, I stuck around there for a while.
Oh, okay.
Just exit interview. You broke a piece of furniture in the exit interview.
That's right.
Good, okay. Well, so to that point, like say you are, and you can even reflect back, you're a young 20-something, you're in one of these corporations, you're just starting out, you're the lowest of the low in the organization. What did you guys find was your source of support in kind of bucking the tide of, you know, you have your boss who wants you to do certain things, you have coworkers who are pressuring you to act a certain way. How do you maintain that balance of, you know, establishing and maintaining a consistent Christian witness, but still getting the job done and fitting in without being a freak?
Well, I don't think you're going to find your support group at the office necessarily. It's great if you do. Sometimes you can. And I think, you know, particularly when you're starting out, you want to be a good example. You want to do everything as unto the Lord. You want to be the best employee, the most productive employee. It's just part of your witness.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you said balance. I think that's important. You can't sell yourself out to your company necessarily. And you've got to maintain some sort of reasonable balance between your work life and your private life. And in your private life, I think that's, for me, that's where I found my support. You got to get plugged into a church or a small group, or at least have some friends that you can trust and share the journey with. Or otherwise, it'll get easy. At least it was for me to get sucked into the work environment. Sure. And stay late and sleep in on Sunday and let that part of your life suffer a little bit. Mm. And
we do not support that at the Boundless Show, sleeping in on Sunday or letting your work life suck everything out of you.
Right.
So
you know, I think the challenge is to lead an integrated life, to not be a different person in the corporate environment than you are when you go to church on Sunday or when you meet with your small group on a Wednesday night. And that can be hard because there's a big difference between being surrounded by people who are like-minded and people who clearly are not. And I know, some organization I've worked in where you've worked on a big project and you all go out on a Friday night and you want to be a part of that community, but maybe don't want to partake in everything that everybody is going to be there is doing. And I think you can do that and still be true to who you are as a Christian. And so, you know, the challenge is, not to set yourself apart, but be that Christian witness in the workplace and yet not be heavy-handed about it, not be I'm better than you about it, because it's a part of who you are. And I know at times I struggled with that, but that was always the goal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What would you say, there are going to be some people listening right now who, now knowing that you all are at Focus on the Family, are going to say, well, yeah, it's easy for you to say, you know, you're just working with Jesus, and you are helping families, you are cooperating with the Holy Spirit to disseminate the gospel to as many people as possible. I mean, that's your current mission. What am I going to do here, sitting in my cubicle, going through all these spreadsheets, to have any eternal significance in the job I'm currently doing? What advice would you have for folks?
I would say that, I mean, I personally probably was in that space longer than anyone else. It's finding a mentor, somebody that you can go to. I think about my daughter right now, who's just in that same place. She's out of college 2 years, working in a firm, and at the same point, and she needs advice. And so finding, you know, forums, online places to go, just to get small tidbits of information that will help get you through. There is impact, no matter if you're working in the workforce that's a ministry or the corporate cycle. There's impact no matter what you do. So I think it's just connecting with those people outside, finding a really strong mentor.
Yeah, if I recall, David didn't work at a nonprofit organization. He was a shepherd. So, you know, I think that a lot of people get in their mind, what you do at your organization, you know, if you work at a church, that's sacred work. And over here, this is all secular work. And you know, I don't think God looks at it that way, and I don't think we should look at it that way. And I think there is an opportunity by being a Christ follower in the workplace. You know, we talked earlier about, yes, people can see that you're, if you're living out your Christian faith, that you're different, and hopefully that you see that. And that's the sort of evangelism part of who you are. But that there's also the discipleship piece in terms of the work that God's doing within you. And so I don't think you should lose sight of the fact that as you're going through your career, God is shaping you. And I know the experiences that I had in the corporate environment have shaped me to be able to do some of the things that now I can do in my role here at Focus. But you know, I know I've had friends say, oh, you went to Focus on the Family. You know, I'd like to go to work at a ministry someday. And, you know, I tell them, you do ministry today. You just don't maybe think of it that way in terms of, you know, whether you're at Microsoft or you're at Compassion International, you're doing ministry. And God's doing ministry in you. And if you're living as a Christ follower, you're doing ministry as well.
That's good. Well, thank you all so much for being a part of this. This was fantastic. We will have to have you back for another session on what it's like to transition into the Christian workplace and the unique challenges and responsibilities that you have there. But Clark, Deb, and Rich, thank you so much for being a part of this roundtable. So
thanks, Lisa.
Great. Thank you.
Brothers, if a man is taken by sin, if one among you falls away, you who are strong in the Spirit of God, gently restore him to the faith. Now be aware, look to yourself, lest you too be tempted in time, and bear one another's burdens in love, and so fulfill the law of Christ. And as we have the chance, let us do good to all men in grace, and certainly to those who are
joining me in the studio for today's culture segment is Nathan Clark George. Many of you may remember him from the past couple weeks. We've featured his music already and are featuring it on the show again today. Fortunately for us, he is in Colorado most of the summer and touring here with his family and leading worship at a camp nearby, which is fantastic. So welcome, Nathan.
Thank you very much. It's a privilege to be here.
It is great. Well, we are going to tackle a few things today. We're going to talk about just you and your ministry and kind of how that came about and what you do and how you do it. We're going to talk about worship music in general and the styles that are out there today and what we think about that. And then talk a little bit about family and maybe your calling and how that plays into what you do and the music itself and then how you make that work. So Nathan is, he was actually named Indie Heavens Acoustic Artist of the Year for the past 2 years. He has released his fifth full-length recording. It is called Rise in the Darkness. You can find it at boundless.org, and we can give you more information. NathanClarkGeorge.com is his website. You can find all about him there, and his fam. He has his family with him today, Patsy and kids, super cute. They're eating apples in our studio right now. So we support the family here at Focus. I tell you, we just bring people in and tell them to be part of the experience. So, but let's go ahead and start just about talking a little bit, Nathan, about how you came into the music biz and why specifically you went acoustic and the specific genre of music that you're doing now.
Well, it was to a certain degree, a pretty natural progression. You know, I played music as a kid and ended up going to seminary and working in a church for a little bit, but I couldn't necessarily accept that calling full-time for my life. I just didn't feel comfortable with that, and that sort of shoves you out of being a pastor if you don't want to be ordained. Mm-hmm. So,
in some churches, anyway.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So I ended up working in a studio, pushing the buttons and so forth, and playing music on the side, and over time, it just progressed. So it was sort of organic, just sort of happened. I love playing music, so it was natural. Acoustic guitar, why it works when you're on your own. Mm-hmm. I love playing Strat. I started playing electric guitar with a band, but it's hard to feed a band. Mm-hmm. And so I took the family on the road and with the acoustic guitar, and it's easier to manage. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, I'm able to take an upright bass player, a mandolin player, and so forth on the road. But for the most part, it's logistical. Plus, I listen to a lot of Simon and Garfunkel and a lot of James Taylor and Don McLean and things like that. And so the acoustic guitar was a love.
Wow. Now you sing actually a lot of scripture in your songs. And how did you decide your style of music, and what has been the reception from folks? Is, you know, because we're kind of coming out of the 90s, 80s and 90s really, where, you know, it's pretty much put as many instruments out there as you can and the laser light show that's going to accompany that. And what kind of has been the reception to your music, specifically, you know, singing straight from the word?
Well, I like simplicity. Mm-hmm. Simplicity is just wonderful. So the acoustic guitar and writing from the scriptures, I think, really it meshes well. Think a harp and psalms. Mm-hmm. You know, the writing from the Psalms really came about from the desire of the congregation that I was serving in South Dakota. They said, hey, would you sing something? And so I started looking, and it's like, well, no, I'm not comfortable with that. And no, I'm not comfortable with that. So I started writing a lot. And so my 2 years as an interim pastor really shaped me trying to write from the Psalms and write from scriptures. And then once I started doing that, I had specific requests. Would you write from Isaiah 58? Sure, I'll try it. And besides that, obviously it comes out of some meditation, some just looking at the Psalms and saying, wow, this would work. They didn't write Western lyrics, but hey, mm-hmm. we could shift this a little bit, and I love the Psalms. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's others that have gone before me and done it, John Michael Talbot, Michael Card, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And they've done a beautiful job, but I took a slightly more James Taylor-ish approach.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So give us an example of that. Speaking of that, what would be your approach? Like, walk us through the process of maybe writing a song. How would that come about for you?
Well, you all used, I think, Psalm 127, and that was really just to look at that psalm. It's a favorite psalm of a lot of people, to look at it and go, okay, you know, I love this psalm. I'd love to set it to music. Is there a chorus? Not really. You know, look at the structure of the psalm, maybe from the Hebrew, sometimes just from English translations, and say, you know, this lays itself out more as just a unified whole. It's don't repeat verses. Some psalms, like Psalm 24, have verses that are obviously repeatable. Mm-hmm. But Psalm 127, you know, let's take it as just straight through and take it as a whole. And so the psalm really dictates to a certain degree the music. And that's really a big part of my focus, is to mesh the depth of the lyric with the depth of the music. Let's not have a disconnect between the music and the lyrics. If we're singing Psalm 127, you know, my approach would not be to make it a metal song.
Mm-hmm. Though, if anyone out there wants to try that, we'd be happy to hear a demo tape from you. Anyway, okay, let's talk about, that's a good lead-in to talking about worship styles. Why do you think the church, the people in the church, cannot decide what kind of music they want to sing? And why is there such a, you know, I think I heard a pastor say recently that he knows of people, you can have total heresy within a church and people will stay. But the minute you, you know, cut out the organ, people are going to start leaving. Or the minute you introduce drums, or why do you think that the church has this as such a hot button, and what are we supposed to do about it?
Wow, it's a hot button. A lot of preferences. Mm-hmm. Something my wife said recently that just sort of stuck with me is I think we forget as a church that we're to be focusing on who we're worshiping rather than who is worshiping. Mm-hmm. And so much of the church is focused on the makeup of the people rather than who God is. And so we lose the object of worship in the form of worship. And I'm not hung up on traditional or contemporary. Mm-hmm. I like one or the other. I come from a traditional background. I grew up with the old blue Trinity hymnal, and mm-hmm. I'm, you know, Presbyterian and all that. But I want to be gracious in style. As long as we're not picking a style to meet the worshipers, that's not my approach. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily think that it's all that beneficial. In fact, if we look at a lot of churches that have done it for growth, it hasn't happened. Right. There's been a big resurgence for orthodoxy and so forth in the young crowd. And so I don't think that style should be our focus. But if we pick a style, let's at least do it really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. With exactly like I said, doing it well. What do you think about mentioning, of course, that you're Presbyterian? What do you think about the kind of movement of folks like Indelible Grace to take some of the older, not only hymns but Puritan messaging and whatnot, and set it to new music?
Well, those messages are obviously incredible. Should we revitalize them? I think, of course, yes. I want to be gracious here. I think what Indelible Grace is doing is wonderful. And there's going to be some gems that come out of that. Mm-hmm. But overall, I think that there's going to be a lot of work over the years. Every time there's a new movement, there's going to be those that dive in and get some things done. And then there's going to become some that come behind them that do it even better. Mm-hmm. And Indelible Grace is doing a great job. Musically and words, sometimes I feel like there's a disconnect if we're talking about opinions here. Mm-hmm. But I think
about opinions, so just lay it out there.
Okay, opinions. I think musically sometimes there's a disconnect. We have the these and thous, and we have, you know, sort of simple folk music. And does it bring in a new generation? Perhaps. I'm not so sure. I've had a couple friends say yes, and I've had a couple friends say it's weird. But I think that the idea of revisiting these old texts are wonderful. We just need to take some time and say, let's match that music with the same depth. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't necessarily put a Nickel Creek song to, mm-hmm. you know, Martin Luther.
Yeah. Do you think there should be a system of, well, first of all, do you think there's an accountability kind of lacking in the church for responsible lyrics, especially those that are used within churches, kind of the whole, you know, Jesus, you're my buddy kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Really, what's the responsibility of the church to have, you know, a good orthodoxy when it comes to worship lyrics?
I think it's incredible. We must be responsible. It's incredibly important. But if we look at the seminaries, who are we training? Mm-hmm. We're training pastors and we're not training musicians. Hmm. And musicians preach just as much as pastors do. I was asked to write an article, which I never got written, and the title of it was going to be, you know, Preaching Singers or something of the sort.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the singers really do, and lyric writers really do shape our worldview as a public, at least in the Christian public. And I think it's important that we train. We encourage musicians that are writing, especially in the church, to seek out theological help and look into history and say, where do I fit in the theological spectrum? And know where they are and write lyrics that reflect that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have any personal opinions about Bill Gaither? And I'll just preface that by saying that I love him. So, but I mean, feel free to just share what you think about it.
You know, I'm not. I don't know that I have a whole lot to say about Bill Gaither. Perhaps there are some gems there. There's a gem somewhere.
There, that's true. Okay, there are. Bill, again, if you're listening. That's okay. I'll talk to Nathan after this interview. We'll set him straight as far as that goes. So tell us what's coming up for you. What's next?
Oh, my. Touring, and touring. A lot is happening over the next several months, possibly doing a video shoot of the family on the road. That's going to be crazy, having somebody with a camera in the motorhome.
Wow.
Motorhome life is hectic as it is. Mm-hmm. We call it the incubator for sanctification.
Okay.
And so having a cameraman there is going to be possibly a challenge. Mm-hmm. A new CD, perhaps, by this winter.
All right.
I just hired a manager. You know, I'm an independent and staying independent, but...
That's hardcore.
There's a lot of T-shirts. I just got T-shirts in the mail.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Yeah. It says NathanClarkGeorge.com on it right there.
Okay. Just great marketing. Good. Good tie-in. So, well, good. And you... just tell us a little bit then as we close, just the idea of family on the road and kind of marrying that with your ministry and how you have been able to do that. You know, what have been the lessons learned there?
Well, taking the family on the road came about because it was either, you know, do music or with them or don't do it. Mm-hmm. I did not like the idea of leaving behind. And also I got really sick of road food, and in the motorhome we can make our own food.
Sure.
So, you know, two really huge reasons to take the family on the road, but it's really shaped us. Living on the road has been wonderful. Why? We're family. Mm-hmm. What more needs to be said? And no reason to be separated constantly. But it's shaped us. It's shaped who my oldest son is. Jonathan is changing because we're living in a motorhome. Same for all the rest of our children. And it's changing me. It's pointing. The motorhome brings out everything that's the worst in me and everything that's the best in me. Hmm. We're living in less than 300 square feet. And that means we're stepping over each other literally. And you must be gracious or the roof comes off.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is wild, but awesome. So we have been talking to Nathan Clark George here. You can find out more information about him at NathanClarkGeorge.com. We've also been listening to his music today, so make sure that you check that out. We're glad to hear that you are in Colorado and that you come through occasionally. I remember him being at my church, I think it was last year, or maybe a year and a half ago, and it was just great to get to know him. So you can do that as well, and as we lead out of this interview, we're going to go ahead into some of his music. Opening up this week's inbox, we have a question for Candace and Steve. They're going to both address it in tandem here. And this question comes from Noelle. And she says, my boyfriend is 22 and I'm 19. We both have about 2 more years of college left, and that's the problem. Anytime I begin to utter the word marriage, I'm quickly showered with a million reasons from my parents why they think it is wiser to wait till after college. Not to mention that I'm too young and have not been dating long enough, and so on and so forth. And the ever famous, you should just pray about it, which really means you should just pray about it until you agree with us. I understand, I really do, but we think that the right people but the wrong timing could prevent a great marriage that could or should have happened. That could go for getting married too soon or too late. Considering that we've been discussing marriage and why we want to move in that direction and what it realistically looks like and the million sacrifices we may have to make, waiting 2 more years would be like holding our breath that whole time. I want to listen to my parents' wisdom and get their blessing, but I also want to help them understand why waiting 2 more years might actually be a pretty unwise decision. How do I do that? Is waiting until after college really the wisest decision for all Christian couples? Could it actually be a good thing? And at what point do we just need to make our own God-guided decision?
Noelle, thanks so much for writing. The short answer to your question is waiting. The answer for all Christian couples is no. Steve and I know some really great longtime married couples who got married in college and they did well. But really, I think the challenge here is for you to present to your parents the evidence of why you could successfully get married while you're still in college. And it can't just be an emotional response of, well, we really feel connected and we think God wants us to be together and therefore you need to bless it. But they're going to need some practical evidence for why you two think you're going to be able to pull this off, because it won't be easy, but I don't think that it's necessarily the wrong thing.
You know, I think your parents probably reflect what's become the conventional wisdom that a generation ago, 19 and 20 was very average age for people to get married, and it was very common for people to marry in college or shortly after graduating. And I think what's happened is a lot of parents are following the conventional wisdom without quite knowing what's behind the conventional wisdom. And I think at the heart of it is a good intention for you. I think their desire is to see you start strong. And I think that's just been translated for a lot of people into start strong means wait until after college, wait until you've got your financial ship in order, wait until whatever. And I think the problem with that is that it can go too far, as if waiting is always better. An extra year is always better. Extra financial preparations are always better. And I think what some parents are forgetting is that they can, in their good intentions, put people in a position where they're overly cautious, where they've gotten too cautious for their own good to be able to start strong.
If you're able to show your parents on paper how you can make this work financially, you've got, you know, you've thought through where you're going to live, you're demonstrating that you're not going to have your parents' basement as your solution for how you're going to make this, you know, feasible. And two, to show them that you're serious about finishing, at least your husband, your future husband, finishing his degree so that he is in a position to support you and future children. And they still say, no, you have to wait because it's just not right for kids in college to get married. I think at that point, you can then start to pray about bringing in some other mentors, other voices, whether it's your pastor or maybe a professor or someone who could be the objective voice of reason to give you some feedback to say yes or no, you guys are ready to marry, you're mature enough, this plan makes sense, or to say, guys, you're missing some things here and you need to pay more attention to what your parents are saying.
Yeah, because we both obviously feel strongly about respecting parents, of bringing great counsel, wisdom of parents, of pastors, of mentors into a marriage. I think all of this goes back to the context of the wedding vows that you used to talk about, going into marriage soberly and advisedly. And I think that's what a lot of parents are concerned about, is that they worry that their children are not going into marriage soberly and advisedly. And I think if you demonstrate that, the thing that you might have to communicate is, if their concern is you're just too immature, that it might be worth reminding them that marriage is what matures a lot of people. And that the key thing is that you demonstrate that you're willing to commit to the vows of marriage, because those are hard. And a lot of people do not have what it takes going into the marriage to commit to the commitments. And I think if you're willing to say, we are willing to stick this out for better or worse, richer and poorer, and all the vows of marriage, that's what's going to carry you through a lot of the temptations and struggles and challenges of marrying at an age that a lot of people have begun to see as maybe too young, which in actuality is old enough for taking on those kind of commitments among serious people.
Great insights. Well, Noelle, let us know what happens, how it works out. Keep us posted. And all of you, please write to us, editor@boundless.org. Write to us with your questions. We always want to address them here on The Boundless Show. For this week's show, I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. We hope to see you around next time, where we will be finishing up. We won't be in the middle of the Olympics then, I don't think. So we'll see how that plays out. But until next time.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.